Now let's welcome our speaker, Gloria A.
What an order. Oh, my gosh. Good evening. My name is Gloria, and I am an alcoholic. A lot of steps to come up here. Thank you, Melanie, for asking me to come out and share. And I was telling Beverly before this meeting, last time I spoke here was about 14 years ago, and I've always been very grateful to this meeting because I got a raise from my job because of this meeting. I had come dressed up to work, and my boss was so concerned I was interviewing, she pushed through a raise for me. So thank you very much. I do not expect the same thing this time. My sobriety date is May 29th, 1985. I have a sponsor that I use as a sponsor. I have a home group, which is a women's group on Monday night in Chatsworth, and I know when my next meeting is. And all those four things are not what keep me sober. But what they do is they keep me here in Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time so that I can hear about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that if I work them and apply them in my life, I will find and have found a power greater than myself that allows me to stay sober a day at a time. And so just a kind of brief qualification, I never met a social drink. I was a daily drinker by the time I was 19 years old. I came from a family that drank a lot, and that's not what makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is when I pick up a drink, I drink until it's done, you know. I drink until I'm done. And I never really thought, I never tried to control my drinking. I got here at the age of 28 years old, and I thought I was too young to be here. My last year of drinking was pretty much like it started. I was living in a little apartment in North Hollywood. A man that I would have died for, you know, love of my life, that we had had a secret relationship for a year and a half, because, you see, I'm the kind of woman who will sell myself to the lowest bidder. Finally decided that he didn't want to be with me anymore because he's what the book talks about as a hard drinker. We got together and we drank alike. He was my soulmate. We got together because we would go out after work, and he'd tell me a sad little story about his awful little marriage. And I would be, I mean, it's so straight out of the big book. It's so sad and pathetic, you know. And I was commiserating and understanding. And so what happened, though, he left that marriage, and we kind of moved in together. But you see, he wasn't an alcoholic. So what used to drink alike together, what happened was that once we moved in together, he stopped because he drank because he was unhappy in that marriage. And once he got out of that marriage, he did not have the physical disease of alcoholism, so he didn't have to drink anymore. In fact, what he discovered was jogging and Sprouts. I, on the other hand, am an alcoholic, and I could not stop drinking a day at a time. I, on the other hand, would come home to that man, and he would give me that look, and he'd see that huge bottle of wine going down every night, and he'd give me that disgusted look, just that disgusted look, you know. And I embarrassed that man terribly at a wedding, and one of my hardest amends was to that man. So anyway, finally what happened was after about a year and a half, he decided he could not live with me anymore. And again, we were working at a company together, but we hadn't told anybody we were dating because he wanted to keep it a secret. And so he found me an apartment very quickly. He says, I can't live with you anymore. It's your smoking. And I still don't believe to this day that's what it was. And he quickly found me an apartment in North Hollywood, California. And that is where I did my last drinking, my last year of drinking. North Hollywood, California, on Camarillo Street between Lancashire and Tahunga. I did not know when he moved me there that that was a hotbed of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so my last year, I was living in this little apartment with two cats. And I had put this aluminum foil type stuff. It was not aluminum foil, but it was silver, and it kept the sun out, and it kept you from looking in. And because I didn't want the manager to see the cats, but the real reason is I really didn't want anybody looking in. You know, I had nobody in my life. Nobody was calling me. I lived a very sad, you know, very lonely life, very pathetic. My all I did was I would get up, I would go to work, I would have to go to the Denny's at lunch, because it had a bar there. And I thought it was the only Denny's in town that had a bar. But I've discovered since then, many of you have found other Denny's that had bars in them, you know. And I would go every day at lunch, and I would tell myself, if you go to the bar, you'll get served faster. I don't ever remember eating at the bar in Denny's, you know. I did not know at that point in time, at the age of 27, that I could not get from morning to afternoon without a drink. Did not know that. All I knew was that I had to go and I would drink, and I would drink at Denny's, and then I would come back and I would work, and then I would go home, and I always stole from petty cash. I always reimbursed it, but my first sponsor said, you know what, did you take it without asking? I said, yes. She goes, then that's known as stealing. You have educated me on a lot of levels I really did not want to be educated about when I first got here. You know, but I, so I would steal from petty cash every day because, you see, I never quite seemed to have enough money so I could buy that big bottle of wine on my way home so I could go and I would drink and I would just pass out. You know, that was my life. I was going nowhere. I had stopped driving a lot because I am a very dangerous drunk. I am a drunk driver. I can't tell you how many times I came to on the 101, on the 405, on Laurel Canyon, on the various canyons, wondering, just out of a blackout. And then I would black out again, you know. And what I do know today, and this really scares me, the longer I'm sober, the more that scares me, and I'm really glad about that, because the truth is, you know, they say if you go out, the best you can hope for is to start off where you left, and that is where I would start off, is coming to, hopefully, out of a blackout on the 405 somewhere. So anyway, but so I'd stopped driving because that was just a little too much fun, and I had no place to go anyway, and I had no money to go drink in bars. I've never been a bar drinker because I could never get the men to somehow buy me the drink. I guess I was not a program of attraction. So this last year, I was just drinking at home. You know, I would go home and I would drink and I would pass out. You know, and that was my drinking. You know, that was my drinking. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was actually, I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous in March of 1985, because what had happened was, this is where I did. That last night, that night, I came to on the 134, excuse me. I came to on the 134 in a blackout about 2 or 3 in the morning, and I'm clutching for Valium, and I don't know how I know they're Valium, but I know. And I remember this. Every time I drive the 134 at that point in time, at that point on the 134, I remember this coming to. And I'm coming to, and all of a sudden I'm remembering where I had been and what I had done. And I could not believe, I remember at that moment, I could not believe how desperate I was for any sense of human contact and what I was willing to do to get that. That utter incomprehensible demoralization. And I blacked back out. I do not remember getting home. And I came to the next morning on my couch. Somehow I had gotten home. I came to the next morning on my couch, and the television's blaring, and it's March of 1985. And this is when all the Schicksal hospitals and all the treatment centers, and they were all advertising, you know, Saturday morning, what better, you know, target market, what better way to get them as they're coming to, you know. And I'm sitting there, and I have this moment, and I realize that I want to die. And I realize that I am not going to die. That, in fact, I am going to continue to wake up day after day after day in this utter demoralization and incomprehension of what I am doing to myself. And so I'm one of those that the only thing I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was from this movie Days of Wine and Roses. And so I'm one of those, I looked you up in the phone book, and I called a central office, and I said something like, I think I may have a problem with alcohol. And a man had answered, and he said, can I take your phone number? You know, and I always tell the newcomers, and gosh, you know, what a great, you know, breath of sobriety here. You know, I tell the women I sponsor, you know, your job, I told them, you know, I hope you be desperate. I hope you be desperate. And desperate doesn't mean 100% desperate. It means 51% desperate. And I was 51% desperate. And so I gave them my right telephone number. And a few minutes later, the phone rang, and I still remember looking at that phone on that coffee table in this disgusting place that I was living. And I thought, are you going to answer it? And I did, and he had found a woman to call me back. And I said again something like, I think I may have a problem with alcohol. You see, but I'm still looking good. I have a job. I have a car. The car used to be square. Now it's a little round, but who cared, you know? You know, in my head, I'm still fine. But there is something wrong with me. I remember thinking there is something intrinsically wrong with me as a human being. There is just, I am garbage. I am garbage, and I don't know what's wrong with me that I cannot seem to stop this. And so what happened, I said, I think I may have a problem with alcohol. And then I remember I said, but I don't have enough money to go to a treatment center. And she laughed. She said, oh, honey, I spent $30,000 on treatment centers, but it's Alcoholics Anonymous that got me sober. And so she talked to me for a few minutes, and then she said, oh, I and a friend would like to come over and talk to you. And I remember thinking, no, you know, I think I was afraid they were going to come steal something, you know. And trust me, there was nothing in that house to steal. And so I said, you tell me where you are. And little did I realize that I was living right down the street from one of the big, there was a big speaker meeting at that time. Now, I used to always walk down to the Ralph's. There was a Ralph's at the corner of Lancashire and Camarillo. There was a church there, St. Matthew's, and there used to be a big Ralph's. So I would go down every Saturday night and get my big bottle of wine, and I'd see all these people hanging outside this church and smoking away, and I'm thinking, oh my, they're dedicated, aren't they? You know, hanging out at a church on a Saturday night. Little did I know that was Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And so what happened was they told me there was a big meeting down there and to just go. And so I wanted to look good, so it took me all day to sober up. But I was still desperate. That demoralization was still with me. And so I remember I walked my way down to that church. And I am very grateful for greeters at meetings, because I got to tell you, it took every ounce of courage I had to walk to the church. And courage is not lack of fear. It is doing it despite the fear. And so I don't know that I could have walked across the threshold. Once I heard all the loud laughter and the bright lights, I think I would have just run. But there were two greeters at the door, and they just pulled me in. I'm thinking I'm looking good, and I'm sure they saw a newcomer, you know. And I'm so glad they pulled me in gently, and they didn't make me sit in the front, and I'm so very grateful for that, you know. They let me sit in the back, but they did find a woman to sit on each side of me, and they got me a cup of coffee. And I don't remember what I heard of that meeting. I do remember thinking, how low can you go? You have now come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But I was desperate, you know. I didn't know where else to go, you know. I had done therapy in the past, you know. I had done cold turkey. I tried to do it for him, but I was a daily drinker. I could not stop. And so I looked down, and I heard a guy take a cake for 10 years and talk about being diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic. For whatever reason, that was a program of attraction for me, because I came back the next day. And so I lasted about 3 weeks. And it's like I tell the women I sponsor, your job is to get them to the meeting. You don't know what the newcomer is going to hear. Trust me, it's not going to be your wise spiritual wisdom you're trying to hand off to them. You know, you need to help them get to the meeting. So I lasted about 3 weeks. But you see, I started to feel better. I remember thinking, you know what, I'm only 28. You know, I've made so many mistakes in my life. If I'm not really an alcoholic, I don't want to make this mistake. So, you know, I had the big book. Thank you very much. I now knew you just don't drink so much. Thank you very much. And I had gotten a new job down in Anaheim now. And so I remember thinking, I'm going to be fine. And so what happened was I had gotten a new job down in Anaheim, and I'm still living in North Hollywood. And I went out. I was working there for a couple weeks. And I went out with a bunch of people after work and had a couple of drinks. And you know what? The heavens didn't part, and I didn't get hit by lightning. And you know what? I was fine. I didn't come to in a blackout, you know, coming home. But what happened, it didn't take long, because one of those things that I had not realized I had heard in those 3 weeks I had come to you was some of those yets, you know. And now I have to drink in the morning to get in the car, because the fear is back, and it is back worse than ever. Because you see, I'm at a new job. And the truth is, I know I'm garbage, and I'm just waiting for them to find out that they've made a huge mistake. So I have to drink to get into the car to drive from North Hollywood down to Anaheim. I have to drink at lunch to get from the morning to the afternoon. And then I have to drink before I get back in the car. Before I leave Anaheim to come back. And I did that for about a month. And my last drunk was Memorial Day week in 1985. I remember it started with my brother's weddings. Weddings and me have never done real well. And so I don't remember much about the wedding. I do remember trying to make it about me and not about him. And then I came back to Los Angeles, and I went back to work. And it was the first day back after Memorial Day. And a bunch of us went to Charlie Brown's after work down in Anaheim. And my boss was there, and I remember I'm drinking wine after wine after wine after wine, and my boss, and when I drink, I don't know about you, but when I drink, my mouth starts to flap, and it's flapping and flapping and flapping away, and I'm saying all the things that I shouldn't be saying, because you see, I'm trying to impress you, because you see, I know I'm garbage, and so I'm trying to be something I'm not. I'm trying to be bigger and better, you know, and trust me, I am not impressing you. And my boss has given me that look like, shut up, you know, and I can't. And all of a sudden, like silent radio, again, I don't remember reading this. Like silent radio, I saw a line from the big book in my head that said, and before he knew it, he found himself pounding on the bar one more time, wondering how he got started. And I knew at that moment it was over. And so what happened was somehow, I don't remember getting home from Anaheim to North Hollywood. I do not. It was a blackout one more time. But what I can tell you is I came to in my apartment in North Hollywood on the phone to him, who could not stand me anymore because I kind of stalked him a little bit, asking him, why don't you love me anymore? And when that man heard who it was, the disgust in his voice, I could not believe that anyone could hate me as much as this man hated me. And so the next morning I woke up hungover, I'm sure, you know, and some of the women had forced telephone numbers on me. And so I called one of those telephone numbers and I said, are you going to a meeting tonight? She said, no, but you know where we are. And she hung up. And I'm going to tell you, that woman gave me the greatest gift. Because it says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I had to be willing to go to any length to get it. I'm not sure I really wanted it, but I knew I did not want what I had anymore. I could not live the way I was living anymore. I did not want to. I wanted to die and it wasn't going to happen. And so I did. I crawled my way back to Alcoholics Anonymous and my first meeting back. I used to go to a lot of meetings at this place called Studio 12 in North Hollywood. And it was a men's recovery house, but they had a lot of mixed meetings there. And I walked back in just terribly embarrassed and humiliated. And what I can tell you is what most impressed me was that you remembered my name. And nobody had remembered my name in a very long time. And so you pulled me back in. And I'm not one of those I was happy to be here newcomers. I got to tell you, you know, I really went out of my way. I think I was really daring you to ask me to leave. So I went out. First of all, you made sure I had commitments. Now, I never thought about turning down the commitments. And it just never occurred to me. And I'm very grateful for that. But you made sure I had commitments so that I would show up and be here in hopes that I would hear the message. So you allowed me to be the really the hostile, you know, cookie lady, you know, the really mean greeter, you know, I will make the worst coffee in town kind of coffee gal, you know. And it really was. I think I really wanted you to ask me to leave. And the old timers would just kind of, oh, honey, just keep coming back, smile as they pour half their coffee out and pour water in it, you know. And you know what? And those commitments kept me coming here. And then you kind of nagged me about, well, you need to get a sponsor. Well, finally I asked a woman to get it, you know, asked her, you know, will you be my sponsor? And I remember she said, no, but I'll take you through the steps. Well, that wasn't quite the answer I was looking for, but I called her my sponsor anyway, you know? And then I just, you know, you told me if you could drink every day, you can go to a meeting every day. So you told me these things that just somehow I couldn't argue with, you know? Okay. It's not like I had a great social life. You made sure I had commitments. You said if you can drink every day, you can go to a meeting every day. You nagged me into getting a sponsor, and you really highly recommended I start working these steps. And so I did start working these steps with that sponsor, and I'm very grateful. Like I said, I was not easy to work with. I was really unhappy. I was really angry, which I discovered through a lot of inventories. That was fear. It was all fear. I was frightened of you. You know, we were just talking before the meeting about, you know, not liking people. And I'm a woman who at the age of, you know, 12, I had a poster on my wall of Lucy from Peanuts that said, with her hands on her hips, I love mankind. It's the people I can't stand, you know, because you all scared me. You all scared me. I've been very equal opportunity. And so I came to these meetings and I started to trudge this road, you know. That's where I began to discover, though, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't realize everything I'm telling you now, I've learned in hindsight. I had no idea what you were giving me. All I knew is that if I went to these meetings, that for an hour and a half, the headache that I had, because trust me, when you think as much as I think, you have a headache, I would get relief from that headache for an hour and a half. You know, and I would have some place to go, you know. And then you start to tell me things like, you know, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. And I remember sitting in Studio 12 thinking very hard, you know, it would be just my luck. If there be such a thing as a miracle, I'd be trotting out that door right as it's about to happen. You know, that kept me here for a very long time. So I started to work the steps with that sponsor. But you know what? The truth is, it says, you know, the promises happen midway through the ninth. And it says you're really not going to have a spiritual awakening until the culmination of the 12 steps, you know. So what happens, I started to work the steps with this sponsor. And then when I was about 3 years sober, you know, I remember thinking I'm bored with my life, you know. And I'm a mover because, you see, when I'm bored, what do? I move. And I don't just move across town. I got to move 1,000 miles someplace, you know, and quit a job and move. And I hadn't finished the steps. You see, I wasn't a free woman. I had no power greater than myself. I wasn't free. I hadn't done any of the amends, you know, but I just didn't want to do this thing anymore. And so what happens, I remember sitting there, I'm going to move. And my mother was about to retire. My sister was about to declare bankruptcy up and down here, and so she wanted to move. And they all decided to move up to Seattle because I like Seattle. And so what happened was I told my sponsor, I still remember, I told her, I was sitting across from dinner and saying, I'm moving to Seattle. And she gave me that sponsor look. That look that says, oh, well, there's nothing I can say about this, except all she said was, remember, you can always come back. I'm so very grateful for that. And so I did. Within 2 weeks, I was out of Los Angeles, up in Seattle, and within 24 hours of living with my mother and sister, I realized this had been the biggest mistake I had ever made. And I'm going to tell you, Seattle AA is just fine. It is just fine. It was different. It is just fine. And I'm going to say I'm very grateful to the Pacific Group, because there was a gal who had moved up there from the Pacific Group, and they really know how to be of service. And that woman, I was heading out the door, you know, and she put her hand out to me and she goes, you're from L.A. She goes, I'm from L.A. We're going to be friends whether you like it or not. Okay, you know, and then we took every commitment possible, because commitments weren't quite as important up there as they were down here. So I did everything she told me to do, you know. But what happened, you see, I did not have a power greater than myself. I had not had a spiritual awakening. I had not finished the steps, you know. And I'm living with these two women that I absolutely hate. I mean, we have all regressed, trust me. We have all regressed. So what happened was I almost drank at 9 months, and I got on my knees in the kitchen, and I said to this power that I did not believe in, I said, please help me. Please help me. And then I said to my mother, and I got to tell you, nobody, when I told my family that I was getting sober, that I had gotten sober, nobody in my family jumped up and down. My mother wouldn't talk to me for a month, and my father, all he said was, I'm sorry, I set a bad example for you. You know, it was the big elephant in the house. And so I said to my mother, I said, I got to move back to L.A. I said, because I'm going to drink up here. And she would get that look on her face, kind of like that, I don't want to know, I don't want to know, I don't want to know, you know. But so what happened is we all moved back to Los Angeles. And so here, so I can tell you, as I took the second half of the first step, which is my life is unmanageable, when I was signing a 30-year mortgage paper with these two women to buy a house. And I'm living with these two women that I absolutely hate, and I'm buying a house out of fear of economic insecurity, that this is the one chance I'm going to have something that's mine. And I don't care that I have to live with them, no matter how much I hate them. I am down to one meeting a week. We moved to West Hills, and I'm living in an 8x10 bedroom. No aluminum foil, but I'm living in an 8x10 bedroom. I hate my job. I'm going to one meeting a week, which is the Saturday women's meeting. And I got to tell you, when I took my 4-year cake there, I was really angry at my mother, because she had ended up in the emergency room one more time, and I was just a little irritated about it, because, you know, it was my 4th birthday, not that they cared, you know. So I remember I went to that meeting, and I took my 4-year cake, and I got to tell you, not one woman in that room wanted what I had. I saw at that moment how sick I was reflected in their eyes. I don't know what I was sharing, but I guarantee you it was the disease of alcoholism at 4 years of going to meetings. And that's why I say you can go to all the meetings in the world, but unless I was going to work those 12 steps fully and apply them daily in my life, I was not going to find peace. I was not going. I was headed out the door, because the truth is, and this is something Clancy also says, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have done for me slowly what AA has done for me quickly. And if I don't find a way to change how I feel inside, because my nature is restless, irritable, and discontent, if I don't find a way to change how I am inside, I will ultimately have to find a way to fix those feelings. And if I don't do it through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a power greater than myself, I'm going to have to do it the way I know how, which is through alcohol. And the best I can hope for is coming to out of a blackout on the 405 and hopefully not kill somebody. And so what happened was that four. And so then what happened, a woman we both know, she had just found out, Ashley, that she was at this Saturday women's meeting. You never know where the message is going to come from. She had just found out about this Saturday women's meeting, that her sponsor was going to speak, and she just found out that her sister had been diagnosed with terminal illness. And she was too upset, and I remember she asked me, she goes, would you drive me? My sponsor's speaking tonight, and I'm just too upset to drive. And I can tell you that after hanging out in AA for about 4 years, I did know service had something to do with this thing, so I said, sure. And little did I realize that that woman was going to be an Eskimo too, the woman who I believe changed my life, which is my sponsor. And so what happened is I went and I heard that woman share, and that woman shared how at 7 years of sobriety, she and her husband, she was dying out of resentment and fear. She was having a nervous breakdown, but it was all about resentment and fear. her husband and their marriage was over. She goes, there were like three women in AA in the town they were living in, and she couldn't get along with two of them. You know, she was just dying. And I got to tell you, that woman gave me the first hope I'd gotten, because it was 7 years, 7 years, and she was dying. And you see, because I realized that I had thought that if I had not gotten this program after my first year, I'd somehow miss my window of opportunity. And so it wasn't. There was still hope there. And so it took me, I got to tell you, it took me a couple more months to call her to get a little more desperate. And Martha would send messages. She would send messages through Martha, the newcomer. I'm 4 years and the newcomer knows I'm sick. You know, and she would send messages through Martha and say, hey, if Gloria ever wants to call me. But you see, I have to pick up the phone and I have to ask for the help. And finally I did. I got desperate enough and I called her and I said, will you sponsor me? And she did exactly what the big book talks about. She said, why don't you come over and let's talk about it? And she shared her story. And she laid out the kit of spiritual tools. And I remember sitting there in her house in Sherman Oaks on Moore Park, just dripping sweat, dripping sweat, dripping sweat. And I'm waiting for her to offer to take me through the steps. But that's not what the book says. I have to ask for it. And out of my little voice, it squeaked, will you take me through the steps? And I got to tell you, and then I started to go into, she goes, yes. And then I started going, should I sell the house? Should I leave my family? Should I leave my job? Blah, 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 blah. She goes, I don't know. And I got to tell you, she's one of the few people in Alcoholics Anonymous that did not have an opinion on my life, you know? And that is why that woman is still my sponsor today, as much as I've tried to turn my life over to her. And so she goes, I don't know what you should do, but I guarantee you, if you work these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, your thinking will clear up. And when your thinking clears up, then you can make decisions that are right for you. That has held me in good stead since that day. So that woman is still my sponsor. Longest relationship I've ever had, 25 years. And I'm very grateful. Life has been up and down. My dad died when I had 6 months sober, and my mother died when I had 10 years sober. You know, I've had jobs. You know, my sister and I, when we went to sell that house, it got really, really ugly. And I had to become willing, at 15 years of sobriety, I had to become willing to walk away from everything in that house because I was so resentful. I was going to drink if I stayed in that house, demanding what I felt was rightfully mine because she did not want to sell the house. So I moved into a little studio apartment in Sherman Oaks, and for the first time I found a little peace. And I got to tell you, I was really angry with her, very, very angry with her. But Pat made sure I called her. She goes, you know what, I don't care what you talk about. So we talked about the animals. That's all we talked about. And finally, after working these steps and really applying and doing everything that Pat told me and calling her once, finally, I came to a point where I went to my sister and I said, you know what? You don't need to pay me back anything anymore. I don't care. You're my sister and that's all I want. And I was free. I was free. Gives me goosebumps still. So anyway, well, you have made me a free woman and a comfortable woman in my own skin. And I am very grateful to that. And just I keep coming back because, you know, I need you as much now as ever. I do know that I have another drink in me. I'm not sure I have another recovery. Thank you. Okay, what do I do now? Oh, questions. Questions. Any questions? Wow, I must have answered everything in that little 25 minutes. Is there a hand? Did I see it? Okay, yes. Okay, the question is, what is my life like today? You know, my life is, it's real. My life is very real today, and I'm a woman who always had great intentions, you know, great aspirations, great hopes. Today it's very real. It's good and it's hard times. You know, what I can tell is fear doesn't rule my life anymore. I have good friends in my life. I am peaceful. I am a woman. I am a runner by nature, you know, because you see, when I blow through all of you or there's something fearful, I got to go and I got to run. But by working these steps and getting comfortable, because you see, I do believe in a power greater than myself, that I do, and I'm not going to lie to you, I wish I had told you I did it every day, but I do more and more every morning. Rev up the tools and ask God for help and ask God for direction and really try to turn the day over to that God, that I am comfortable and I don't have to worry about whatever's going to come my way, you know? And I didn't know that I wanted peace. I think when I came in here, I wanted him, the house, the job, the money, you know? I mean, who doesn't, honestly, you know? I haven't gotten some of the things that I thought I wanted. But I can tell you is I love the life I have. You know, I sponsor women. I am sponsored. You know, I have good fellowship. I am a part of my home group. You know, I bring value to the table. And I'm a woman who never thought I had any value at all. You know, and I bring value to the table. I try to be of service to the best I can on a daily basis. Some days are better than other. And you know what? I'm glad we have just 24 hours in a day. And I'm glad I heard a long time ago, you know, start your day over any time. You know, I'm grateful to be here. I am blessed. I am blessed that I have history with people. That's one of the best things that I see. I'm a woman. We had no history with anybody. My family, very small, no history. And I have history with Beverly, and I have history with Melanie, and I have history with Manny. And for a woman like me who wanted so much to have connection with people. And even though we may not see each other often, I have a connection and a history with these people that nobody can take away. And nobody, and just to finish up, nobody can take away the peace and comfort that I feel every night when I go to bed, knowing that I did the best I could. I do not have to drink anymore to drown the feelings of discontent and demoralization. Thank you for asking. Yes, sir. So what happened with my sister when I told her that? You know, my sister and I still have a relationship today. And she, what I can tell you is she sold the house for a lot of money, and I'm really glad, I don't know how much. And she moved out to Washington, D.C. We are, you know what, I love my sister, and she is my sister. But I know who I'm dealing with. And so the truth is, and I found out through inventories that actually she's a very fragile woman. And that I have a program. I have a place to go, and she has no place to go. She, you know, we're there for each other. I don't know that she tells me the truth about a lot of things. I mean, we still talk on a very superficial level. I know she's had health problems. I've tried to do what I can for her. But she's making the choices that she wanted to make in life. So I guess what I can say is I did not draw a line through her name, and she did not draw a line through my name. I think the fact that I went to her and said, you owe me nothing anymore, was the turning point, because where we were heading was there was no turning back. It had become so charged, you know. And so what I know is when a resentment, it will take me down, and it wasn't worth it. And so I'm grateful for the relationship we have. It's not the kind of relationship I would have hoped for, but she's still my sister, and if push comes to shove, I will be there for her. Thank you for asking, John. Hand over here. Absolutely. Could I talk about the amends, and particularly to that man? He was, the amends, you know, it was, well, first of all, I'm actually very grateful for blackouts, because there's a lot of amends I've never had to make, so I'm grateful for that. And moving as much as I have, they don't come up to you in meetings because they live in another part of the country. The amends to my, and like I said, the amends to my family was a little hard because nobody wanted to hear it. You know, when my father had died, and I was not able to make amends to my father directly. So there was a man who was actually, God puts people in our lives, and a man that I worked for, he was just the sweet, this man loved me. And he just loved me. And I was able to make amends to my father through this man, because at 3 years of sobriety, he got very ill. And so I would go and visit him at the hospital, and I would read him out of the big book. And I was able to tell that man about how I loved him. He was just a sweet, gentle man. And all the things I wanted to tell my father, I was able to tell that man. When I gave the amends to my mother, she just sat there. She really didn't want to hear it, you know. And all I really, and you know what I've learned is we don't shove anything down their throat, you know. If AA, if me telling her I was an AA made her uncomfortable, I didn't have to shove that down her throat. But what I did do is acknowledge, I must have scared you, and I'm sorry I was so volatile, and I'm sorry I was so needy. You know, I'm sorry for that, but I'm much, you know, but I'm taking care of myself now, and I'm responsible now. And that woman lived we had that house until the day she died. And so I was making a living amends to my mother and just being a good daughter, you know. Now for the man, what happened was, because trust me, he did not want to see me, and he was one of the last ones. And I remember standing outside of Dickens on a Friday night. I had tracked him down, and I had left a message at his work phone and said, this is Gloria. And I was 6 years sober, I think, at the time. And so he hadn't heard from me in 6 years. And I left a message, and I heard his voice. I said, this is Gloria. This is my number. Would you please call me? I need to talk to you. And he didn't have to call me back. And I remember... And so that was like a Friday, and then on Monday he was supposed to call me back. And I remember standing outside of Dickens on Friday night, and I remember telling my sponsor, you know, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And the look on her face after all this time we had been working, she goes, where is this coming from? And I said, well, you know, by the way, I called Rich, and I think she goes, oh, you don't want to make the amends. And she was right. I was terrified. So what way to get out of making amends is you're not an alcoholic anymore, you know? And she said, nice try, but I don't think so. I've heard your story. And so I will tell you that man called me on Monday, and this was before cell phones, so he had to call me at the office. And I had a little cheat sheet of the things that I had done because I had to, you know. And he did not jump up and down. He just said, this is Rich. What do you want? And I told him exactly what I was sorry. I said I was so sorry for how I had embarrassed him and his family at his sister's wedding. I was so sorry that I was so needy and so dependent upon him. I was so sorry for everything I had done to hurt him and that how he was not in charge of my life or my emotional needs, you know. And he just was quiet on the phone. He didn't jump up and down. He didn't say, oh, good for you. And then he said, are you done? I said, yes. And he hung up. And I'm going to tell you again, just like that woman, he gave me the greatest gift because he didn't have to call me, you know. And I was free. I think that is the first time after all the work I had done that I really felt free, because I knew now if I ever saw him, I would be able to look him in the eye and be okay. I had nothing more. There's a line in the big book around the amends, because it says, as God's people, we stand on our feet, we crawl before no one. Because it's not about me groveling and saying, forgive me for just breathing and I'm so sorry. That's not what it's about. It's about acknowledging the hurt I did to you. And about if I can rectify it, I will. But I couldn't rectify this. I couldn't bring back the wedding and redo it. I couldn't do any of that. But I could say, I'm so sorry I did that. And I don't call them one day at a time. You know? And so that's why it says, I love that line, because it says, we stand on our feet, we crawl before no one. Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you for asking. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned early in your praying that you prayed to a God that you didn't believe in. What is the status of that relationship?
That's a great question. Because I remember I must have been 4 months sober sitting at Studio 12, and for the first time I heard this was about God. For the first time I heard that AA was a spiritual program. And I still remember sitting straight up in my chair and thinking, oh my God, I've joined a cult, you know? But all I knew was that for 4 months I had been okay. And I hadn't come home drunk. And I hadn't had, one of the things I first physically noticed when I first got sober was in the shower and looking down and realizing all those bruises were gone. That was really my first awakening, that there was something different here. Because I guess when you're drunk and you're passed out and you got to crawl from one place to the other, you're going to hit a lot of things on your way there. Just like the car, you know, got real round after time. So at 9 months, yeah, I really did not have a God. I didn't know if I believed in a God. And I will tell you, I was 3 years sober and I was, no, I wasn't 3 years sober at the time. What happened was that I had started to work with that sponsor. And when we came to, you know, you got to come, came to believe, you know, I have to find something. What am I turning my will and my life over to? You know, and I had to really think about that because I did not grow up in a family that had any religious bent. In fact, if anything, religion was for fools and children, you know. It was not something that was encouraged. It was pull yourself up from your own bootstraps. So this was a very, very difficult thing to conceive of. And so had a lot of long talks with my sponsor, and we talked about, I couldn't believe, you know, in a Santa Claus God, and I couldn't believe in a God in a cloud, and I didn't think God had a gender, and I, you know, what didn't I, you know, what couldn't I believe in? So we looked at all that, and I had to throw it away, because it says, choose your own conception. And she shared with me about how she had come to her own understanding of a God, and she had done that, and she had been raised Catholic. And what she realized one day was that there were so many things she labeled she didn't believe in. But when she sat in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous and she looked around at all the sober people in that room, and all of them were saying that because of a power greater than themselves, they were sober and happy, she thought, how can I deny that? And so I heard her say that. And so I started with just a very big, there's something going on here. And as long as I'm coming here, I'm comfortable. So I was willing to turn my will and my life over to it. And what I knew is that in the years that I had been sober, I had not endured a lot of those humiliations. And every time I had done what you had told me to do and turn it over to something I don't believe in, it had always worked out. So I began really through the, well, my way isn't working. I'm doing this. I may not believe it, but it seems to be working. And I can tell you it was about that man that I told you that I made living amends to my father through, who had gotten very ill. He died when I had about 4.5 years sober. And I remember I went to his funeral, which is at his partner's house. And I looked at a picture of him on his dresser, and I started to cry, and I realized that had been God the whole time. That God had put, it still gives me goosebumps, God had put that man in my life, and that was God right there who would just love me and love me just, you know, the way I was, you know. And I started to look around, and I realized that God was all around me, you know. And little things, and I started to recognize, just like I tell the women I sponsor, look around yourself every day and try to find an evidence of God. It's there. It's there. But you got to look for it. It's the quiet moments. It's the phone call when you least expect it. You know, it's the paycheck that you weren't expecting get. You know, it's the, I remember sitting on I was 9 months sober and I'm sitting on a coffee shop, you know, and saying, oh my God, if this is the best job I ever get, it's okay. Cause you see, I've been whining about the job. And all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, I'm out of that job and I'm in another one, you know? And I thought, oh my God, that was God, you know? And God doesn't always give me what I want, but God gives me everything I need. And that is where my relationship with God is today. Because at 15, I fell apart. I've had a couple of big hard times in sobriety. At 15, I hit a really big wall. And at 20, I hit a really big wall. And the one at 15 was about a Santa Claus God. I was sponsoring a lot of women, and they were all getting married and having babies except for me. And I was getting resentful and I was getting angry. And a friend of ours, Julie C., was used to always say, what do you mean two newcomers and a panel doesn't equal him, you know? And I was getting really mad because where's mine? I've been doing this deal and they're not doing it as much as I am and they're getting what I want. And I started to get mad and mad. And then what happened was I got fired by about 3 women in a row, and rightly so, you know, rightly so. And what happened was I had to leave, and I talked this over with my sponsor. I had to leave those meetings because, you see, I was starting to believe my own BS, and I had to go and hear the music of AA again. I had to go be one of many again. And so what happens, I started to go out to meetings by my house, you know, and I started to just do everything he had taught me to do. And I did a lot of inventories, and I realized that I had a Santa Claus God, and I had to come to it. Just God is, you know, and God has always given me everything I need. It may not be what I want, but always everything I need. And, you know, Pat always says, you're trying to paint this picture over here. It's an Etch-a-Sketch. And God is trying to paint this Picasso over here, you know. You got to let go of this and let God, you know, just run the show. So my spirituality and my belief in God is stronger than it's ever been. I cannot define it. But I know that it's not about stuff. What it is about peace and comfort. And that every day, as long as I trust this power, this God, the right people, the right situations, just the right things will happen so that I can be comfortable and I don't have to drink a day at a time. And it continues to grow. It is not ending. And I think that's where I want to go. A friend of ours, Rhonda, says, I'm here for the long haul. And I thought, you know, that you'd just stop growing after you got about 20. Well, no, you got to keep growing. And so I'm doing more prayer and meditation, and I'm really seeking knowledge of God. Knowledge of God. My sponsor used to say, your prayer is always help me, help me, help me. I said, well, yeah, help me. She goes, yeah, but it's help me, help me, help me, get my way. I'm thinking, well, yeah, you know. She goes, so now my prayer is help me be of service. Because I do find when I'm being of service and I'm not thinking about me and I'm thinking about you, I am so much happier. And at the end of the day, I'm a comfortable woman, and that's really all I wanted. So does that help explain? Thank you. Other questions? Yes, sir. I'm Ram. Sir. Well, I think Manny can answer that because I was just talking to him about thinking, you know, I've been privileged to speak about once a month for about the last year and a half. Because you see, in between, I'm thinking about, I'm going to move because I want to go back to Seattle. It's going to be better there, you know. Or a girl comes in my life and then I just need to get her through the steps. And then, you know what, and then I'm out of here. As soon as I get her through the steps, I'm out of here. Because you know what it is? I'm always thinking there's something greener on the other side. I'm always thinking my idea, my self-will, my self-knowledge, you know, where's God in all that? There is no God. You know, when I'm thinking that I have this illusions that somehow it's going to be better there. Somehow. You know, so again, a day at a time, I haven't moved. But yes, I have them today. And normally I'm scared about something. Normally there's fear. I mean, fear drives my life. It says 100 forms of fear. you know, fear has really been a decision maker. And that those inventories really showed me how much fear has motivated most of my decisions all through my life into sobriety. So I don't move a day at a time today. And that doesn't mean I won't move someday. But I don't do it when I'm thinking like that. What I do know today is I'm long enough sober that, you know what, today is not the day to make the decision. And like I said, I think I was just looking for something to fix it, something to fill it, something where I didn't have to look at myself, something where I didn't have to, you know, do the work. You know, I could start over again. And yet I got to tell you, on some levels, like I talk about history, I can't imagine on some levels leaving here. I've been here a very long time, and I can't imagine leaving a lot of the people that I do have a chance to see. So, yeah, it is there. I mean, I can tell you, you know, if I don't do what I'm supposed to be doing, that old behavior and old thinking comes back immediately. Well, not immediately, but it doesn't take long to creep back, you know. I do go to, like, I try to go to 3 meetings a week, you know. I'm active in 2 of them. And I sponsor. And what I know is if I don't do what you tell me to do, if I don't do that, continue that routine, and I start to slip away, the thinking comes back, where's mine? I'm getting resentful, disgruntled. Then my best solutions come back, like, well, why don't you move? You know, quit your job. That would be a good one. Yeah, quit your job, you know. And so I just know that that's the crazy thinking, and that's why I need to stay close to you and do give away what you've given me and continue to do these steps. Does that answer? Okay, thank you. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, the question is who noticed? I'm not sure I can answer that question. I don't know who noticed you can't stay sober on AA unless you help others. I do know that our 12 steps says, you know, we have to practice these principles in all our affairs and help another. You know, I help other alcoholics, and I know that for me, it's kind of like a teacher. If I can't give it away, and I have found actually, and that's another thing, where God came from and where the program became mine, where it went from my head to the very fabric of my being was through sponsorship. And by having to explain how I did these steps, how I have come to a knowledge of a power greater than myself, having to try to pass on to them what they, in a way they can understand, that there are times I'd say to myself, do you really believe that? And I'd say no. And I'd have to retract it. You know, because I was telling, you know, again, my sponsor says, you're gonna say things you may not believe. She didn't agree with everything her sponsor said. She goes, but you're going to have the chance to ask yourself, do you believe it or not? So then I found myself getting more honest and telling them really what I do believe. And I do believe. So by giving to them, all of a sudden I'm finding that I'm staying sober and I'm comfortable. And I do know that it's not about me when I'm given to somebody else. And it doesn't mean just alcoholics. It means at work. It means, you know, who's ever the person, the poor sales clerk who's in front of me and I'm really irritated about something and I'm angry that I don't take it out on them. Because they're an easy target, you know, and because that's a lot of kind of stuff, behavior I used to do. So it's real critical. It's kind of the full circle. Thank you for asking. Last question. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Great.
Thank you.
What's better about AA 30 years later and what as a fellowship, what are we not doing as well?
Wow. You know, it's funny. I was talking to somebody. Oh, what's better about AA, you know, 29 years later from when I got here versus now, and what's worse? And is that the question? What could you be doing better? What could we be doing better? Well, personally, I think Los Angeles, I think Southern California AA does it great. I think the meetings in Los Angeles just pull people in, and I think that's so great, and let them be here. You know, for me, the fellowship is, I don't know if it's because I'm older or just life is harder and traffic is harder. You know, I don't do as much fellowship after work or after the meeting anymore. I can't. I got to get home because I get up at 4:30, you know. But that doesn't mean there's not fellowship going on there. I think it really depends upon the meeting. I happen to belong to meetings and go to meetings where there's strong fellowship, there's strong, you know, sobriety and really pulling in the newcomer and including them in the commitments. And I think I do find the same AA. There are meetings, there's a lot of different meetings here all over. Some I won't go back to because I don't But they're autonomous, and that's the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, is each group is autonomous, you know, as long as it doesn't interfere with the group as a whole. And so there are meetings I wouldn't go back because they don't speak to me. But how do I know that that meeting won't keep somebody here long enough for them to finally realize, wake up, you know what, I'm not quite hearing the solution anymore. But because that meeting allowed them to do whatever it is they were going to do long enough to say, I want whatever it is that group over there is doing. So, you know, I don't really know. I think as long as we hold true to these traditions, which to me, you know, a lot of the traditions can be broken at the public level, you know, I think we really need to hold true to, you know, understanding those traditions, and I started to learn more about the traditions when I was about 20 and started going to that. I think that is our responsibility. I think it is our responsibility to help the newcomer get to a meeting. I think it is our responsibility to tell the newcomer the truth and not coddle them. And by that I mean, you know what? Just tell them the nature of their disease, that it's not okay. You don't have to go out. That's not, you don't have to. You can have one sobriety date. You know, and it doesn't mean you're bad if you do, because thank God there are people who have struggled coming in and out, and thank God we have those stories to say it's possible. But it's also possible to have one. So, you know what? I feel of personal importance that I need to hold true to the traditions in my meeting, and that means, you know, again, if I see someone. Personal, this is personal opinion, texting during a meeting, I say, you know what, I put my hand on them, say, please, you know, this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's distracting to me, and I'm not sure you hear the message, you know what I'm saying? Because again, it's about respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, if I hear someone speaking in a meeting while somebody's talking, you know, well, you know, am I, I'm a little bit of a Nazi secretary right now at my women's meeting, but you know what? When we have announcements, that's not a call. That's not a license. That's not a respect for Alcoholics Anonymous if everyone's talking doing it. So, you know, it's kind of like I believe I have a responsibility to pass on the kind of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous that I got. Some people like it, and I'm sure I'm on some people's resentment list. But I don't care because I want this program to be the way I came in. And so for people like you who ask those kinds of questions, I think as long as we're passing the message on and the doors are open and you got greeters and you got coffee and you got a speaker, you know what? That's the AA I came into. Thank you for asking.